Welcome to Inside Admission, the podcast that gives you a behind-the-scenes look at the college admission process with the experts in and around college admission.
I'm Andy Palumbo, host of the Inside Admission podcast, and I'm joined today by journalist and author Jeff Solingo. Welcome to the podcast, Jeff.
It's great to be here, Andy.
So, Jeff, why don't you introduce yourself for our listeners before we jump into a bit of Q&A?
No problem. So I've been in and around higher education for almost 25 years. I got my start in, actually for this podcast, probably even earlier than my professional start, interning at U.S. News and World Report, working on the college rankings as a summer intern in the summer of 1994. But most of my work in higher education really started in 1997 when I was a reporter, started as a reporter at the Chronicle of Higher Education, which covers colleges and universities around the world, really their trade magazine. And I worked there for in a variety of roles, including editor, for 16 years. Left in about 6-7 years ago and started writing books around higher education, including the most recent one, which is we'll be talking about today, which is Who Gets In and Why? A Year Inside College Admissions, which was published about a year ago in the fall of 2020.
Great. Thanks, Jeff. So before we jump into the college search process and some of the things that are happening now, let's roll back 5-10 years or so to your own college search process. What was that like? And, you know, how did you navigate that process? What was the outcome? And what are your thoughts on it looking back these 10 or 12 years later?
I wish it were only 10 or 12 years later. So first of all, I did apply back in the dark ages, pre-internet. So I got kind of tired after typing out a few applications. So I don't think I applied to more than 3 or 4 schools. But what was interesting to me is, you know, my mom didn't go to college. My dad was a high school music teacher. I had, you know, a decent counseling in high school, but most of my high school didn't go to college. If they went to college, they went locally in northeastern Pennsylvania. And so as a result, when I got cards in the mail, and I was helped a lot because I had an older brother and sister who went to college. Mm-hmm. But when I got postcards in the mail or the view books back then, I wanted to be a journalist. I knew I wanted to be a journalist probably since I was in 7th or 8th grade. And so I looked on the back of these cards or these view books about colleges, and if they didn't have a journalism major, I kind of tossed it aside, right? So because I thought, well, to get a job in something, you need to major in something, right? I didn't kind of really know what I know today, obviously. So that's really, as I think about back upon my search, that really defined where I looked as a result. So I looked at schools that had, you know, journalism, communications majors, and ended up at Ithaca College in upstate New York, which is about 2.5 hours from where I lived. It was a great place. I had a great undergraduate career. And I really was the mentors that I met there that I really associate with everything that I've been able to do today in life. You know, I had a great mentor in the advisor to the student newspaper. I had some great mentors and faculty members. You know, it's something that I always tell students today, that it doesn't in some ways matter where you go or to success afterwards. It matters how you go, and getting those mentors in college matters so much to success after college.
Yeah, I couldn't agree more. Actually, one of my mentors from my freshman year of college ended up being the best man at my wedding. We ended up working together when I went into higher ed, and you know, super strong connection. I think that's an interesting point you make, because I completely agree. I mean, there's so much research behind the fact that students who make strong connections with peers and with faculty or with staff are the most successful students. What are some of the ways in which students nowadays are able to make those connections, as you've spoken to countless folks on college campuses and college students? What are the ways in which students in 2021, you know, are able to foster strong bonds with people on campus?
Yeah, in India, I'm fearing that we were losing this. We're losing this a little bit because of COVID. I also don't think it's something that students necessarily look for in admissions. I always encourage them through the admissions process to really get a feel for whether not only could you view yourself there, but are there people available during the admissions process that make you feel welcome? You know, so if you can't connect with faculty members and see faculty members and advisors and coaches and advisors to clubs and things like that during the admissions process. If you can't sit in on classes and get a feel for the campus during that process, what does that say then when you end up there as a student? So I always encourage students to really kind of get off the tour, for example, get to see if you could figure out to see faculty members and things like that, and advisors and others. And because, you know, for example, if you're a recruited athlete, you're going to have that relationship during that process, right, with the coach, right? You're gonna have that built-in mentor essentially during the recruiting process. And unfortunately, and as I even mentioned at the end of my book, I wish we would recruit more students like we recruit athletes, because they do get this kind of hand-holding through the admissions process that really helps them understand if that's the place they want to be, obviously, beyond athletics. But I'm starting to fear that too many students are really a spectator to the college experience, that much like we've turned high school now into a series of hoops that we jump through on our way to college, we're starting to do the same thing with college. There's a bunch of hoops that we jump through on the way to getting that degree to get that job, because so much now of higher education is about the job, right? It was 30 years ago when I was going through college, but you know, we didn't really worry about it freshman or sophomore year, maybe junior year, we started talking about it. And then senior year, we really started talking about it. But really, it was there this exploratory piece of it in early on. You know, I made a small pivot in college where I went there thinking that I would become a television journalist. And as I always tell the story, on day three of my freshman year, I met somebody who would become my college roommate, David Muir, now who's anchor of ABC World News. And I realized that he had a lot of talent even back then. And I realized that television wasn't for me, as you probably could tell by this, from this podcast. And so I decided to go into, back then, the old, you know, newspaper ink and printing presses. And so that was a little pivot, but I was able to kind of explore and figure out that's what I wanted. And it took me a couple of years to figure that out. Again, small pivot. It's not like I changed majors necessarily, but we've lost that, I think, in college. And when students go with this singular focus on that job and the singular focus that I just have to get in and out, they kind of lose that exploration part of college, and they lose finding those mentors who might encourage them, by the way, to switch majors and in a way, because, sure, they're more passionate about something else.
So, Jeff, I started this podcast with two real goals. One was to give people a glimpse, behind the curtain of college admissions, you know, having this access to people like yourself and to folks in my seat at other universities. You know, is an opportunity to give people a greater understanding of what actually happens, cutting through some of the mythology. But the other piece was something I took away from the pandemic, and it was, you know, the ability to just pull up a Zoom call and be in front of 50 students or have a one-on-one with someone, 12 states away. Wanting to show the human side of admissions, you know, you're like, we're here in our houses, connecting as human beings. And I think that was one piece that gave me some hope for the first time in probably over a decade, that there could be ways for us to tamp down some of the stress and anxiety around the college search process. And so, you know, one of the goals I have is trying to show the human side of the people who work in around this field, and to try to break down some of the fears and misconceptions of, you know, a group of cloaked figures in a dark back room making life-changing decisions, right? And so we know that's not it. But you have an interesting perspective and authority, being, an outsider who, when doing your, writing your book, Who Gets In and Why, some of the research, you were embedded in college admissions offices, yet you don't have the bias of remaining at that institution and representing that profession. So you have a unique experience and credibility to talk to our listeners. And I'm curious about two things. You know, what surprised you most about the process, and what surprised you most about the people doing the work?
Well, first of all, I'm glad you said I have credibility. I appreciate that, because some people think that even if you were in the process for as short as I was in it, that I don't still have credibility, that you have to do it, right? There's a lot of people in social media and other places that sit in jobs that you sit in and basically say, if you haven't done admissions, you can't talk about admissions. I always say, even when I talk to parents, I'm not a counselor. I'm not an admissions officer. I've never worked in college admissions. I tell them that right from the beginning. I like everything in journalism, I've always observed, but that's, I think, the power of journalism. The power of journalism is to observe from an outside perspective and to explain. Because to be honest with you, Andy, I don't think people inside admissions explain the process very well to people outside of it. I've been on a number of panels over the last couple of years with your counterparts across the country. I think people like you and others who are on Twitter all the time do a very good job trying to demystify the process. But I will tell you that most of your counterparts across the country don't do that. They use all these terms and shorthand that most teenagers and even counselors and definitely parents don't know. So what surprised me about the process? I think one of the things that I was really surprised about was just how deep and wide the applicant pools are, particularly at these institutions that are getting just more and more applications every year. And really how that has put a lot of pressure on the offices as a result. Because, you know, we can't create more time in the calendar. And so you have more applications, same amount of time to get through them. And that these are pretty deep applicant pools. In other words, you're getting really qualified students. And so these are not easy decisions to make. And I think that people on the other side, meaning parents and students, really understand their local context. They understand where they sit in that pool, but they don't really have an appreciation until you do what I did and sit in there and see these day after day, just how deep these pools are. In terms of the people, they take this work very seriously. And I think that people, again, on the other side, meaning parents and students, think, oh, they're just crushing the dreams of our kids, right? I don't think anyone in those rooms enters that way, right? Because they all went through this process themselves. And it was interesting, Andy, the year that I was in the process, several of them had kids themselves, had their kids going through the process, usually at another institution. And so they saw it from the parents' perspective as well. So these are human beings that often have kids themselves, often have been through the process, often were denied by quote unquote their dream schools, a term I hate anyway. That's what really surprised me. And I think surprises most parents. And one of the reasons why in the book, I tried to get into some biographical details of some of the people that you were meeting in the process.
Thanks, Jeff. Appreciate that. So in Who Gets In and Why, one of the things that stuck out for me was when you describe, you know, a pre-COVID college fair. You know, you walk into this local event complex. There's tables all over the place. There's an energy. There's a buzz. They hand you a plastic bag and you start going to table. And I sort of chuckled, but found it a good comparison. You know, you suggested those students walking to that college fair is the rough equivalent of someone showing up at a car dealership and saying, you know, I heard I should get some type of an automobile, maybe a pickup or a fast roadster or a minivan. Is there even much difference between them? I just know it needs to have four wheels. And so, you know, I got a good laugh out of that. But as I think about sort of the information challenge of both students and the schools that are there trying to communicate their value in a sea of similar imagery and of similar 30-second snippets of conversation. I guess I'm curious, as you think about what you experience both doing your research, but also as you've watched what's happened during the pandemic, if you have thoughts about what are better ways for students to get information about the colleges they're interested in, and how can parents help facilitate that process? Or are they going to the same types of sources as students should be going to?
Yeah, I think that what ends up happening is that, again, we get so focused on the names of schools that we lose perspective about why we're going to college and what we really want to get out of it. And so I think from an information standpoint, I wish that colleges would kind of get together and start to put together, like, what differentiates liberal arts colleges from research universities? What differentiates publics from privates? What differentiates urban institutions from more rural institutions? Right? Because in some ways, students are making decisions at the uber level first, at that macro level, and then taking a deeper dive. Right? I know, Andy, at WPI, right? project-based experience is very important, right? At a number of institutions, undergraduate research like you do there is very important, right? Like, why can't we get all the that may be interesting to a lot of students. So why can't all the institutions that do similar things that you do get together and say, okay, here's what we think is the value of project-based and undergraduate research or whatever it might be, whatever the thing is. And then students can start to make differentiations between the institutions once they're at that level. But what ends up happening is if we're at the 50,000 foot level, students dive down to 250 feet immediately and say, okay, I'm going to go to WPI in your example, right? Rather than stay at that 50,000 foot level for a little bit longer in a college search and say, what am I really trying to get out of this? And then taking that deeper dive on a smaller set of schools. Because otherwise it makes the process way too difficult for students and parents, because they're trying to make this differentiation between schools before they really know what they're looking for.
So it's an interesting point, Jeff. And I think, my guess would be that part of the reason you don't see more of that is because there is a fear of not being distinguished enough and not being distinct enough to stand out in a crowd. And so I think we have a lot of colleges who continue to try to add majors, to try to be more comprehensive at a time when I think there is an argument to be made for being more focused in your approach, being more specific about who you are, who you serve, and what you aren't. And so I think being at a place like WPI, I benefit from a lot of specificity. And I think we've seen through a group called Cache, which is a collection of STEM universities, we've seen, at least engaging with school counselors, there's been an extreme demand, as you point out, because it helps them provide a group of schools to students to consider. These are schools that do this type of education well. They each do it differently. They each have their own distinct flavor or approach. And so I think that is an interesting commentary on sort of how colleges could cooperate while also competing for students. So,
yeah, I mean, sorry, go ahead.
Oh, no, go ahead. Go ahead.
Yeah, I mean, I think that's the thing. And I think that this idea that colleges may not be distinctive enough, and so that their brand name matters, or that the residence hall matters, or that the library matters, whatever it might be, right? I think that's why when you take these tours, we tend to focus on, I think, the wrong things as a result, because we're so focused on the look and feel of the university rather than really what's in the plumbing, which to me is really what equals student success down the road, either at the end of college or after college.
Enjoying the podcast? Find us on the web at InsideAdmissionPodcast.com. And you can find and engage with us on social media, where our handle is Inside Admission on Twitter, Instagram, and Facebook. Now back to the pod.
A lot of what we see in the news tells us how difficult it is to get into college and how expensive college is and how crippling student debt can be. And there are certainly cases and examples where all of these things are true. But as you and I know, there are many, many schools where these things are not necessarily true. And I think one of the most interesting things about your recent book is that you've provided readers with a framework to consider colleges as either buyers or sellers. So can you tell us what this means and why you think it can be a helpful tool for students concerned with both admissions and affordability?
It's a great question, Andy. And so in the process of reporting the book, I spent some time in the spring of the year that I was following not only institutions, but students. And I'd be sitting in these high school counseling offices when students would come in, and they would say to their counselor, their high school counselor, "Hey, I got in to X university, but I didn't really get as much aid as I expected." And the conversation then moved to getting in or not getting in to money. And I thought, wow, that's really interesting. Why are we talking about money so late in the process? for students. Now, granted, these were more middle income, upper middle income students at some of these schools that I was visiting in their counseling offices. But this is true, I think, across the income spectrum. And so what ended up happening then as a result is that I decided we need to really have a lens on financial aid in at the beginning of the admissions process. Now, of course, we have that with the net price calculator and things like that, but I felt like we needed a better sense of kind of aid policies at the macro level. And so what I did is I came up with this idea of buyers and sellers. It's an easy thing to understand, I think, for parents. And really the shorthand is sellers are the most elite universities. They have a lot of money. They have a lot of applicants. They focus most of their financial aid on need-based aid. They're very generous with that need-based aid, but they don't really need to discount tuition. The vast majority of colleges are buyers, right? They do need to discount their tuition. They need to leverage their financial aid budgets a little bit to draw students in. It doesn't mean, it has nothing to do, by the way, and I say this throughout the book, about the quality of undergraduate education, but it's more about their financial aid philosophy or their financial aid, the way they do financial aid. And I think that parents and students need to know that at the beginning of the admissions process so that when they're putting together their list, they have a balanced list of buyers and sellers on it. Because otherwise, if they have all sellers on it or close to many sellers, they may not get into these places. And more so, they may not be able to get the aid that they want. And so I really wanted to try to move the conversation up around financial fit much earlier in the process than I think some parents and students really have it. Because just like admissions is a black box, so is financial aid. And I think that many students and parents just throw up their hands and they'll say, we'll figure that out later. And then later is too late from an admission standpoint.
Thanks for that, Jeff. I appreciate it. And speaking to the very human nature of this work, you may have heard my 18-month-old screeching in the background. So we're keeping it real here on the podcast.
If my kids were home from school right now, I'd be fighting in the background as well.
So, one of the things you and I spoke about briefly after the book came out and during sort of that first year of COVID was, you know, what would a chapter on COVID admissions look like if you were to write it? How have things stayed the same? How have some things accelerated and how have some things completely changed based on the research you did for the book and the things that you're now aware of happening?
So it's fascinating, right? So I did report this book the year before COVID, so 18-19. And you know, I thought at the end of the cycle, so Varsity Blues broke, and I thought, wow, that's really going to upend this book. Little did I know in a year that COVID would upend it in a different way. And what I think is happening is that obviously we've had a huge move towards test optional, and that's probably the biggest change here. We've had a huge move towards virtual events and reaching students in different ways. So I'm actually going back into the process this year when the paperback comes out to see I think test optional is the biggest question mark out there. And as you well know, test optional is not new in higher ed. It's been around for a very long time. A lot of schools were test optional before the pandemic. But I think what's interesting about the group of schools, not only that I profiled in the book, but the group of schools that went test optional for the pandemic is that they didn't do it with any sort of strategy or approach, right? They just were kind of forced into it by the pandemic. And I think they're really struggling as a result with how to come out of it. Do they stay test optional, for example, or not? They're really struggling with, I think, admissions around test optional because, again, they didn't plan for it like other schools did. So I kind of want to see that from an insider's perspective. And so that's one of the reasons why I'm going back into the process. But I'm also kind of curious from the student's point of view out there, the prospective student's point of view. I think there's a lot of questions around test optional from a prospective student's view because they don't, and I know that you're a big proponent of this because it kind of gives institutions kind of a sense of they could do whatever they want while applicants are there left trying to guess, right? So this idea of test blind, right? Like if you're not going to use the test, then just tell us. And I think that's what students want to know because otherwise it puts them in this kind of middle ground that I think is unfair to a lot of students because schools say we're test optional, but are they really? And I think that's the question that's out there. So I'd rather schools, if you're going to use the test, well, you know, Georgetown, as we all know, loves the test. You should just say it, right? Just say it. You love the test. We're going to use the test. If you don't love the test, stop using it then. But this middle ground of test optional, I think, really confuses applicants and just adds, by the way, to the lack of transparency in the whole process.
I think that you bring up a great point, and I would argue that I think the test optional landscape has changed as a result of it, because I think what happened when schools were planfully adopting test optional admissions up through, say, 2019, you know, for the most part, I don't think these were cynical or necessary changes. These were changes made largely based on institutional values, about concerns about the relative predictive value of the test, the inequity. You know, standardized test scores have longstanding problematic correlations with family income, with gender, with race and ethnicity. And so, you know, places like WPI, that was a reason that we went test optional. But I think that because so many others who had been hesitant to go test optional moved optional, there was sort of the shift in the landscape. And I think there's a reasonable criticism or skepticism among students and families. And I do think it's on those of us in higher ed to figure out ways to be more transparent with data. One way to combat this is to show how decisions are made and to show, you know, how many offers of admission were from students who did not submit test scores versus those who did. So I think there's still a middle ground for those schools who are committed to test optional. But, you know, at WPI, we took the opportunity to go test blind because we felt that if we're going to even allow these tests to be optional, you know, the power and privilege that's baked into these test scores will be reinforced. It'll be reinforced optionally, but it still will play a part in the process. So I think there's a lot of merit to what you've said there. And we won't go into merit. We don't have enough time. I'm curious, you know, you have been studying college admissions for quite some time. As you think about students who are approaching the college search, what is one or two pieces of advice that you would give to them?
Well, so I think one piece is what I talked about earlier. Before you take that deep dive and start to put names to paper and say, or on your iPhone or wherever you put the list of schools that you might apply to, really start to think about what you want to get out of college and get a sense of what are the types of colleges out there. So that's number one. Number two, just be reasonable about academic fit, about social fit, about what you want out of college, about financial fit. Be very clear about that. Have clear conversations with your family and with your counselors about financial fit. I think that we have the, you know, college is a dream, but at the same time, it's also a ticket to the rest of life, and it really is the only ticket, unfortunately, now to the rest of life that it has to go through college. And so the stakes are so much higher as a result. And I think that everybody has ratcheted up the conversation about college as a result. And so I would encourage students to just be reasonable about what they want out of college, understand what they want out of college, and then put together that list that is much more balanced than I think many students do. Finally, high school really happens once for you. Enjoy it. I see so many students getting so stressed out about the college search so early, and then they end up in college and they essentially miss their junior and senior year of high school. Because they were always trying to guess what the person on the other side of the desk, the admissions officer, wanted in their application. And you know what? As you well know, every college wants something different. Every admissions officer wants something different. They're also looking at the context of the class. And so enjoy it. Do what you want, because at the other side, that will help you get in.
Yeah, that's excellent advice, Jeff. And just a follow-up question there. One of the things that's a regular theme on this podcast is that stress and anxiety that seeps into high school surrounding this process. And as an admissions professional, I'm curious, from the things that you've seen and the families that you've talked to about this, you know, what one or two things could colleges do to actually start to turn the tide on the stress and anxiety that faces students and families going through the process?
Well, I think that they should be more transparent. And it's interesting, Andy, that out at the NACAC conference this year in Seattle, I hosted a panel around the book, and the theme of the panel was around transparency. And I think that people on the panel who were missions officers themselves, some of whom were in the book, talked about this transparency as a balancing act. Because once you're more transparent, once you tell students and parents more about the process, especially, by the way, well, we do this or we follow this and do that in terms of admissions, then there will be some parent out there, somebody out there who says, but I know the student who did this and got in, right? They're always going to find that exception. And so it's much easier as a result for colleges and universities to be less transparent because they don't want to get into those one-on-one fights about the student who got in and why they got in. So my advice, though, is to be as transparent about the process overall. I think the stuff that you do, for example, being on Twitter, being in social media, doing this podcast, Rick Clark at Georgia Tech is great about this as well. We're very public about the admissions process with his writing and so forth. I think the more that colleges and universities and people in your roles can talk about the process, about your institution. And by the way, talk about it in real terms that people in, you know, outside of universities talk about admissions, right? Stop using the lingo, stop using the shorthand and talk about it in real ways. I think that parents and students will really appreciate that.
Thanks, Jeff. Well, that is definitely one of the goals of this podcast, and we're going to be bringing on folks in my role across the country to try and do just that. So, you know, you're a parent yourself. I'm sure this is giving you tons to think about personally as you go through the research for this book and just in your regular day-to-day work. As you think about the process that's approaching you and your family in the coming years, and you think about the parents out there who are just starting now, through all that you've learned, what advice would you give parents?
I think one piece of advice is not to like let this overwhelm your junior and senior year. And I think that's easier said than done, I think, in a lot of families. But again, as I said earlier, you really have one shot at high school. I was just visiting my folks in Pennsylvania and pulled out my high school yearbook and reminisced there for a little bit about high school. And I was like, wow, it's a great time of life. It's a changing time of life. I know it's a struggle for a lot of students. It's not the best of times for everybody. And it wasn't the best of times for me either. But you know, there were a lot of learning opportunities in high school. And I feel like if I had been overwhelmed by the college search and so focused on what was next instead of what was right in front of me, I would have missed out on a lot of stuff. And so that's one piece of advice. The second is that, again, don't rush through this. You know, I think that one thing that we've learned this particular year during COVID is that college can wait in some cases. I think that we've seen, you know, as I wrote recently, there wasn't the gap year that everybody talked about.
Yep.
Happened during COVID. You know, the numbers don't show that, for example. But there's no reason, there's nothing set in stone that says you have to graduate from high school and go to college 3 months later. Now, do we know that students are more often to go to college if they do that? Sure. But if you're not ready, take some time off. If you can afford it, if there's other things you can do during that time. So don't just sit in your bedroom, for example. But I think it's important that we also put this focus in our culture that you have to go to college and you have to go to college right after high school. And so that's the other advice I would give is, you know, take a step back and try to understand what you're really trying to do here.
Great. Well, thanks a lot, Jeff. You've heard it here from Jeff Salingo, one of the busiest people in and around higher education. Jeff, why don't you tell people where they can find you and some of your work, the web, podcast, anything else you want to share?
Great. So I co-host a podcast called Future You with Michael Horn. So you can find that on Future You Podcast on the web and download it or subscribe to it on anywhere you like to subscribe to podcasts. I also publish a newsletter called Next, which you could sign up for on my website, jeffsalingo.com. There's also other resources on jeffsalingo.com, including the buyers and sellers list. You can also follow me on social media at jsalingo is really my most popular handle in most places. And look forward to engaging in conversations about this incredibly important topic.
Great. Well, thanks a lot for joining us on the podcast, Jeff. I appreciate it.
Great. Thank you, Andy.
Enjoying the podcast? Find us on the web at InsideAdmissionPodcast.com. And you can find and engage with us on social media, where our handle is InsideAdmission on Twitter, Instagram, and Facebook.